97 KBUL. Tommy B, it's the bulletin. For Christmas 1984, my dad gave me a 200-page, three-ring binder titled A World War II Diary. I didn't know he'd kept the diary of his service, so it came as something of a surprise. Of course, I knew he had served in the infantry during World War II, but little else. And then in 1984, I was only a day-by-day account of the most tumultuous time of his life. Like many sons of World War II veterans, I grew up hearing occasional war stories and learned enough to know what a good job our soldiers had done. But like so many other veterans, my father didn't talk much about the blood, the death. What hurt the most, the loss of his men and his buddies. I think this diary helped bring him a little more closure in his personal struggle to put the war behind him. He was proud of his service for his country and proud of his accomplishments, and although he was awarded the Bronze Star, he never considered himself a hero. The heroes were the ones that didn't come home, he told me. I'd heard that same phrase time and time again from many veterans. And when my parents were first married, my mother placed all his medals in a display case, and I remember asking Dad about them. Which one's your favorite? And without hesitation, he pointed to the combat infantry badge. That one. His answer surprised me. Why that one? Not the Bronze Star? Well, because being in the infantry on the front lines, you can't get much closer than that. At the time, I thought he meant closer to the war. But as I've grown older, with a family of my own, I know now what he really meant. He was telling me you can't get much closer to your buddies. You can't get much closer to your own fears. You can't get much closer to God. The words of Andy Atkins, the son of his father. You can't get much closer than this, the diary that became the book. Delighted to have you on the show, Andy, and good morning.
Good morning. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thank you for joining us. Thank you for putting your dad's words down. He's kind of a gruff guy in the book, Andy.
He is, and I think many people that served in the war, they felt a lot of these same issues, a lot of the same experiences, but once they got back into the real civilian life, I think that they became, the war shaped them obviously, but I think that they became real citizens with a lot of honor behind them.
Yeah, I think so. In fact, reading the early part of, by the way, his diary starts the way a lot of veterans reminisce about this. It was Pearl Harbor that got him in, right?
Well, actually, my dad was at the Citadel going to school. He was in, which is a four-year college, military college in Charleston, and he started in 1939. But when Pearl Harbor hit, he still had about 18 months left. He wanted to quit school, join the Army, and go over and fight.
That's what I was thinking, but he didn't, though.
No, he didn't. His dad, my grandfather, basically said, "Sit back, son. This is going to be a long war. You'll be in it sooner rather than later." And sure enough, he did. He finished, the Citadel, graduated with political science, went to OCS training, Fort Benning, joined the 80th Division out in the California, Arizona maneuver area, started doing the training, and ended up in Europe fighting the war.
Yeah, and going back, we'll get to that in a second here, but, going back to the beginning and what the words that you mentioned in the introduction, as well as talking about, your father's war stories, we've had a lot of guys on, we've talked about Pearl with a couple of folks right here in the studio from Billings, Montana, who were there that day. And, they all say kind of the same thing about how they feel about the war and about not talking about it much. Why do you think they didn't talk about it much?
I think it was a period of history that there was so much grotesque, so much killing and murder on both sides, and I think they just, those are things you just don't talk to your families about. But I will tell you this, since working on this book, I've met a lot of veterans, and I've met a lot of baby boomer kids who are veterans' kids, and what I found is that veterans will talk to other veterans about the war. I mean, they'll get into the details, but they won't talk to their kids. However, I have noticed that if the kids are there in the same room, then the vets will still talk with vets. And that's one way to kind of understand a little bit about what our parents went through.
That's an interesting note, yeah. So it's like they have to have somebody that understands it, even if there's somebody there that doesn't.
That's true. And I think a lot of it is that, you're not looking into the eyes of your own kids. you're looking into the eyes of someone else who's been there and done that, and they understand, you know, these things. They understand the feelings. I mean, the tears that you see from a veteran when they're at a memorial service, I mean, those are real tears that just bring back so many years of memories.
Yeah, it's those memories, those tears, and what we're talking about that go back to how I felt when I read your book, is that this really was truly the greatest generation. And I'm not sure that there's going to be, I mean, I know September 11th has redefined a whole new type of veteran, maybe, and it'll be years before we understand, I think, how they actually feel. But I feel about this generation the way they've been described. There's just something that those guys went through.
Yeah, absolutely.
You start, I should say your dad. Now, you had the diary. How much of the diary is the book? How much did you have to fill in?
Well, my dad's diary actually starts in what's chapter 3 now, Crossing the Moselle River. When I started working with the editor, they suggested, actually they told me to do this, is that I need to go back and start what made him into a soldier. So I did a lot of research. I went up to the Citadel, looked through archives. I did a lot of research online. I've been to museums, memorials, and I actually had to write the first two chapters. Now, my dad had kept, I guess his parents had kept all of the letters that my dad wrote home, which I have, all the original letters. So I was able to glean a lot of information from that. And I'll tell you, some of the letters that were first written from the Citadel when he was just, you know, 18, 19 years old and coming out on his own, and then the letters towards the end of the war, I mean, this is like two different men.
Really? That's interesting.
Yeah, and I think that's the way it was for most veterans. You know, they go in as citizen soldiers, as Stephen Ambrose has so well put it, and then they've molded them into trained killers. To fight this war, and then when the war was over with, they were expected to come back into, you know, being a regular citizen. Well, one of the things I've heard that veterans have told me, the biggest thing that's helped them is the GI Bill, is to help them get back into a real life, make a living, have a family, all of those things.
That's an interesting note to keep a thought of. You talk also about, I don't know if it was your dad or one of his friends who mentioned coming home on leave and having a girl, but the girl didn't like him anymore. He wasn't fun anymore, I guess she said.
Yeah, that was Sergeant Christopher, one of the first guys who actually went back to the States on furlough and then came back to the company. And there was a conversation that my dad, actually this is one of the stories he did tell me before he passed on, is that the guy had changed. You know, he wanted to just be nice with, have a nice quiet time with his girlfriend, with his family, and not go out and party all the time. And I think his girlfriend was comparing her girlfriend's fiance, who was actually based in Scotland, and the letters that he would write home every day, but the big difference was the guy in Scotland was more of a support military and really wasn't on the front lines, so he probably had a lot more time to write home.
Yeah. You described the crossing and that his first crossing. It reminded me a lot of my dad's story. It's about the only part of the war my dad ever talked about was crossing the Atlantic.
Mm-hmm.
And your father, did you notice this, by the way, his first action was actually on September 11th.
Oh.
That's kind of interesting.
Yeah, I didn't realize that.
I'm talking to Andy Atkins about his father's diary. He turned into a book. You can't get much closer than this. Combat with Company H. 81 millimeter. He's a mortar guy, right?
That's right. That's right. 81 mil. And in the Army, there's, you know, they break things out in threes. They have regiments. There's three regiments in a division. And then there's battalions. There's three battalions in a regiment. And then in a regiment, there's actually in a battalion, there's three rifle companies and one heavy weapons company. And so you actually have nine companies, Company A, B, and C are rifle companies, Company D is a heavy weapons company. Those belong to the 1st Battalion. My dad was in the 2nd Battalion, which had rifle companies E, F, and G, and my dad was Company H, which was heavy weapons. And inside that heavy weapons company, they have mortars, 81-millimeter mortars, and they have heavy machine guns. And the being in the mortars, you have about 6 guys supposedly to every gun, but you never had full strength. You know, sometimes you had 3, sometimes you had 4. It literally took at least two guys to carry this mortar around, because the total weight of the tube, the bipod, and the base plate was about 135 pounds. And then whenever you're going to shoot this thing, you've got to carry the mortars, which weigh about 6 pounds apiece. So they actually had ammunition bearers that went along. So that's why there was about 6 guys assigned to a particular mortar.
It sounds like sometimes, at least in one issue, the commander didn't have any idea what the mortar could do. The guys kind of took offense to that.
Well, I think that's part of it is, you know, some of the battlefield battalion commanders who are sort of sitting back, you know, a couple of miles reading maps, they're not up there with the men. Now, not all of them, but there were some, you know, some in my dad's battalion, but obviously throughout the entire war. But, you know, you basically have an attack or a strategy or a goal that you're going to take, an objective, like we're going to take this hill. So you have all of these pieces of armament and men and resources available to you. How do you manipulate those to take that objective? The mortar platoon was really in support of the rifle companies, so that's why they moved them around in battalions, so that even though my dad wasn't right at the front line, he was probably 100 to 200 yards back, and in some cases even farther. It just depends on how far out that the objective is.
I'm talking to Andy Atkins about his book, You Can't Get Much Closer Than This, Combat, with his father. He took part in D-Day, and he actually got wounded, and that was when he got the Bronze Star.
That's correct, yeah.
Right.
He was wounded in a battle in Civry, France, which, in his words, was a poorly attacked, it was poorly planned and followed through, because there were 2 large hills overlooking the town, and the objective was the town and not the hills, but yet you've got Germans looking down their necks, firing mortar rounds into the town. So they were able to kind of pick out various companies as they were going down the hills into the town. His wound was actually a roof fell in on him, and a large beam from the roof pinned him down, tore out his ligament in his knee. And he was knocked unconscious, and his good buddy couldn't get a hold of him through the phone lines. So he actually came and found him and got my dad unconscious and sort of worked him so he could get so that he could walk back to get to his men. And then during that whole battle, this was actually when he was awarded the Bronze Star, even though he was wounded, he still had to get supplies in and out of Civry to the riflemen that were fighting in that town trying to take it.
When he's in the hospital and thinking about his buddies and all of that, probably the strongest part of the book, in my opinion, Andy, I'll read here from the end of his hospital stay. He goes to London. When Harry and I returned from London, I thought I was tired, and after the lights were out, I still couldn't go to sleep. I tried to relax and think about our trip to London, but still no sleep. The voice in my mind would not leave me alone. What's the matter with you, Atkins? Why can't you sleep? You know why you can't sleep. You're thinking about something. You have a problem on your mind. You're afraid to face it. You're going back to France soon. You don't want to go. You like it here, don't you? It's nice lying around in clean, warm beds with no worry and no care, no responsibility, and having someone to wait on you. You were anxious to get back to your men when you were in the hospital, weren't you? You were a hero then. Fell out of place in the rear, but you haven't changed your mind since you got back to England, haven't you? You like it out here. You've had it so good, you'd be a fool to go back. Hell, you're a pretty smart fellow. Wouldn't be hard to convince these doctors that your leg couldn't stand combat duty. You've done your share, buddy. Let someone else live in that hell for a while. But have you really done your share? Did Bob Strutz do his share? Got his head blown off, remember? How about Ray Witinski and Hank Walker? Did they do their share? What'd they say if they could read your mind now? Hell, you're no hero. They were the heroes, but then you're no coward either. And if you live through this war, you'll have to live with yourself. And the doc came around the next morning to look at my leg. He said, "How's that leg, Atkins?" "It's okay, Doc. I'm ready to get back to my outfit."
Yeah. that was a very powerful part of that book.
Does that pretty much say it all?
That does. And I think, you know, even veterans today who are fighting, they go through this guilt trip of, especially when they're in a battle and they come out alive, but they've lost buddies. I mean, it's hard. You and I have never experienced that. I mean, I spent time in the Navy and saw a little bit, but nothing like this. And how do you walk away from something and you ask God every day, why am I allowed to live and yet my best friend was not? I've heard that many times, and that's something that veterans live with every day.
Indeed. You can't get much closer than this. Is the book Andy Atkins took his father's diary and fleshed it out into this combat chronicle, I'll call it. You know, it's interesting, the shortest chapter in the book, Andy, is the R&R in Paris. I mean, you know, he talks like about a page and a half about R&R, and everything else is this frontline bombardment, you know. And I told Bell last night when I was reading this that it's very, I told the listeners this morning too, it's very, you know, the reason I played combat going into this thing, every World War II story or movie I've ever seen, and, you know, I mean, there's your dad being played by those actors. That's the way I feel about it.
Yeah, and I felt that too. I mean, when my dad gave me this book in 1984, you know, I was floored. My dad and I have always been close, I mean, except for those times when I was a teenager. But aside from that, we've always been close. And, you know, I read this book two or three times, but then I put it away, you know, and life goes on and stuff. And my dad passed away in 1989. He died of cancer. So he never knew that I was working on, well, he does know, but physically he didn't know. But the point is that there were several things that happened over the last 10 years that sort of got me working on this. The book Flags of Our Fathers by James Bradley, excellent writer, excellent book. I mean, there were so many parallels between he and his dad that he put in the book. He was an inspiration for me to finish writing and finish working on this book. The second thing is that, you know, we've seen a lot of war movies before, but until Saving Private Ryan came out, I don't think people really understood a lot of the gross, a lot of the killing, a lot of the blood and the guts. I mean, that really brought out a lot to share with veterans. And then there's Band of Brothers. So each one of those things that came out, I think, really spoke. And even though they're showing a lot of horrors of war, I think that it is an honor. A real honor to our veterans to be able to show the rest of the world this is what our guys went through. Yeah, it's Hollywood, but dadgummit, it's pretty damn close.
Yeah, absolutely. One more paragraph, I think, which is sort of the crux of the whole point. It's hard to describe the bonds that form between men during war. We're all destined to fate, whether we live or whether we die. Behind the lines, we can laugh and take it easy, but up on the front lines, we depend on our buddies, and our buddies depend on us. In the heat of battle, some men rise and perform far beyond what they think they can do. It doesn't matter who stands out or who doesn't, as long as we all stick together as a team. But those men who fight the front lines together form a strong, never-ending bond, a relationship of respect, admiration, and loyalty that stays with you throughout your life. I believe it stays with us in the afterlife, too.
Yeah, that's very powerful.
You gotta love your dad.
I do, very much.
Very good. It brought back lots of memories of growing up with my dad. As I mentioned to you right before we hit the air, Andy, he was the company officer there in France, supplying these guys that your dad talks about. Your father mentions the 40 and 8, the French rail cars are so famous. My dad told me about that. And he brought back some concentration camp pictures, apparently of which your father saw firsthand. I see some of the pictures in the whole photo journey in the book, by the way. The photographs are a story all by themselves. Thanks so much for including those.
I went through back and forth with the editor about which ones to include, but I thought it was very important that we include what our father saw, and that's what you see in the book here.
Very good. I'm glad you did. Andy Atkins. When's it out, by the way? This is a preview copy I have. Is it on shelves soon?
Actually, it is on the shelves. I got my copies about a week and a half ago. My website is the www.80thdivision.com. division.com. That's 80thdivision.com. You can buy it off of that. You can buy it through Amazon. All of the major bookstores will be able to get it. So it's available.
Good for you. And now, how do you feel now that it's done and it's printed and the hard work is over?
Well, my whole goal is really to share this, and it really, even though it's my dad's story, the more veterans that I talk with, it's really their story. And there are so many veterans who don't talk about the war with their kids, and we're losing veterans thousands every day. And I wanted to have this book and share it with not only vets but also their kids, for them to, I guess, better understand and appreciate what our fathers went through during the war.
Yeah, good for you.
Thank you.
Can't get much closer than this, Andy Atkins. I wish you the best. Thanks for joining us for our Veterans Day week.
Thanks, Tommy B. I also wanted to ask or relate to you. Thank you for the opportunity that you're sharing with veterans today. It is truly an honor, and I'm very glad that I could to be part of this. Thank you.
You bet. Our pleasure. Thanks again. You can't get much closer than this, Andy Atkins. I'm Tommy B. Andy.
Thanks very much, Tommy B.
Good to have you. I appreciate and applaud you for putting his words down. I got to know your pop. I think I got to know you a little bit. And, you know, every day, like you mentioned, we're losing them. So, bless your heart. Thanks so much for helping us out this week.
Thank you, Tommy B. Have a great day.
You too.
All right, bye-bye.